This is CliffCentral.com. Future CEOs on CliffCentral.com.
Welcome to Future CEOs. My name is Gareth Armstrong. It's great to be with you here live from Johannesburg, South Africa in the Cliff Central studio. And once again, what do we do here on the Future CEO show? And we're doing it again. And that is we bring those individuals into studio that often feel a little too far out of reach. Some might say that they sit in ivory towers. Others may just see them and understand that they're in positions where their time is precious and they don't always get to dedicate it to being able to uplift and assist and share the way that we often are able to get them to do here in the studio. Today is no different. Peter, I don't know quite how to introduce you. You've got a really interesting journey where you've won numerous awards for being an analyst, but then there's an entrepreneur in you, and then there's also a number of other elements to you. I mean, even way back in the day, we were just talking about it. You've got this love for sport, and you're a rugby commentator or reporter, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the way I paid my way through university, was to work at the newspaper.
And I mean, when you say pay your way through university and then you reflect on where you are now versus where you've come from, which I understand, and it's been, I think it was a Forbes article that I was reading, which the headline there was I think, Trailer Park, let's just see, from Caravan Park, I beg your pardon, to managing billions. That's quite a interesting journey right there.
Yeah, so I didn't actually live in a caravan. My dad owned the caravan park.
Okay.
But it makes for a great story.
Yeah, it does.
But yeah, we grew up on a kind of a farm in Boksburg in a caravan park. And so I guess landing up running a listed asset management business is quite a journey from there to there.
It is quite a journey. As I was reading and understanding, from a very young age, you seem to have to really apply yourself in a particular kind of way. And there was a combination of hard work, but then also smarts. I understand you're a bit of a wordsmith, both and also you're fairly good with numbers, obviously. As you reflect back on your early days, what are the memories that come to mind? What are the ones that just emerge, perhaps gently or not?
Yeah, I guess just developing lots of skills. And I think, you know, in this sort of CEO journey and what we're talking about, a combination of skills and being able to implement across those different skills. So being able to be an accountant as well as to be able to write a motivational letter and give a great presentation, you know, to develop all of those. And, you either need to be an all-rounder or you need to have the ability to properly understand what your skills are and supplement your skills with people who can do those kind of things. But it's, yeah, I've always enjoyed writing. I've written a book.
I didn't know that.
So, written a book, done accounts, audited, set auditing debtors' books. So lots of varied experience.
Well, varied experience, but then also a very successful experience. I understand that you won an award 21 times for being the top analyst in the country. Is that correct?
Yeah. So that was the award. I wasn't the top analyst in the country, but I could probably communicate as well as anybody. And often there were guys sitting around me who were much better analysts, but didn't know how to package and communicate their stories. So I think that was a particular skill of mine, which, in life and in business, a lot of it is about, taking your story and what you've got to tell. And number one, having the desire to communicate it. So to be able to pick up a phone and sell to somebody. And secondly, to be able to do that well. So having the knowledge is one thing, but implementing it and communicating it is probably the most important skill that you can have in business.
You said something that makes me think about something I think I slowly and gradually learned. I mean, it's because I've been interviewing for a fairly long time, and I always ask the question, what makes someone, a really solid, great CEO, stand out from the rest? I mean, what's the difference between someone that's kind of just in the position being used by the board to do whatever they require, their wishes, and someone that is a little bit more dynamic and interesting? And some people may say or think that it's this because they're innovative or they're this or they're that. But I actually learned that it's just because they're really damn good salespeople. when it comes right down to it. And you've just mentioned that here, this idea of selling, the ability to sell in different forums, in different ways. A comment or two there?
Yeah, so selling is paramount. And in fact, that's what you're doing in many spheres all day long.
Yeah, internal and external.
Yeah, you're either selling yourself as the CEO to get people to believe into you, to believe in you. Mm-hmm. You're selling your idea to somebody. You're selling to try and get companies, you know, as an analyst, you want to get information and you're selling yourself as credible for people to want to communicate with you. Mm. And you're selling your product to the outside world. Mm. But selling yourself is a big part of leadership, both internal and external, and having the confidence but I guess also being honest about it. Mm. You know, honest sales and communication is paramount. People know very quickly if it's a salesman who's just selling a story. Mm. So to sell appropriately.
Is there, as you were, you're talking about this idea of confidence, and then there's an authenticity that you were, I think, alluding to here.
Yeah.
How do you develop that confidence? And so let's go back into your journey and your experience. And I mean, at one point or another, you were probably someone that had certain confidences in certain ways, in certain areas, but then lacked confidences in other areas. If you reflect back and think about that, is there a moment where you realized where you just didn't have a particular confidence that you needed in a particular set of circumstances, and how did you deal with that?
Yeah, so I think when I go back to school days in Standard 6 at Michaelis, you know, I wasn't the greatest sportsman in the world. Mm. You know, I think when I was born, I couldn't clap my hands. I'd miss.
okay.
But it's I think the lesson is to be the best you can be. So, Standard 6 at Michaelis, I captained the under 14E rugby team.
Yeah. Okay.
And it's you just got to have a lot of fun and realize what you are and what you can be, and developed a lot as I went along. Mm. To the extent that our physical education director, when he wrote his book, he got me to write the foreword to it.
Fantastic.
You know, normally the guy would get the first team rugby captain, but my development and enthusiasm to do things as well as you can do them, and to you know, not beat yourself up when everybody's good at some things and bad at other things. And the things that you're not great at, to understand that, to realize that in the world of business, to supplement that with other people who are good at what they do. Mm. And realizing, you know, kind of a reality check. But then, you know, really developing, understanding what you're good at and focusing your efforts and having confidence along the way.
It's an emotional journey, isn't it, though? So, I mean, I think if I look at myself as someone that was in Standard 6 or Grade 8 way back when, I think I don't know if I had the ability or the maturity to be able to say, this is what I'm good at, this is what I'm not, because everyone seems to be, and maybe times have changed, but I wanted to be the first team captain. How did you deal with some of that emotional, maybe dissonance that you were feeling, the distance, the gap that existed between your desires and this realization, well, maybe it's not going to happen?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of it is inherent. Mm. I mean, I always say probably one of the secrets of success is waking up in the morning and deciding that you're going to have a great day.
Okay.
And deciding that you're going to have a positive attitude. And a lot of success is actually a decision. Mm. And like in a CEO type role, it's you've got to be the rock. You can't be the person who's showing a lack of confidence or uncertainty. So I think there are certain people who can take on, have got the capability to do different roles. If you want to be a leader, you have to have the ability to, you know, keep that smile on your face and make the decision to see the best in all situations, be positive, motivate those around you, and you got to continually pick people up.
Mm.
And a lot of people rely on a leader to pick them up, and actually need it.
Well, as I looked at your journey, so you're a qualified chartered accountant. You have, and so if I start reading your history, there's people are going to raise their eyebrows and say, wow. But qualified CA, Deloitte and Touche back then, that's where you, of course, did your articles. Then you were an analyst, head of research, your chief investment officer for Investec, if I understand correctly. And that was for 7 or so years?
Yeah, I said Investec for 7 years.
I mean, these are big brands and perhaps coveted job titles in big brands. Are you saying that every single day that you woke up, you made that decision, and this was almost by design?
Yeah, so I think I always had a commercial element in Standard 5. Our school didn't have a tuck shop.
Okay.
So I bought sweets from the game store, and at lunchtime I used to sell them to the other kids in the playground.
Okay,
you were learned about my first bad debts.
Okay.
The rather chubby girl who liked all the chocolates never paid me, and you realize that cash flow is king. I realized that at the age of 13. But as you move along, always had that entrepreneurial bent, and I guess an inherent belief that you can, whatever you're doing, you can be the best. Mm. And it's also important to choose things that, where you can excel. You've also got to be realistic. There's things where you just do for enjoyment. Mm. And if you can find something that matches your skill set, with some determination and enthusiasm, anything's possible.
There is almost a cyclical nature to our working experience, isn't there? I mean, there are seasons for enjoyment, and there's probably seasons just to you grind it out and you make money and you're looking for experience. I mean, money shouldn't be the reason you do things, but I think you've got a good story on that as well. But there is a seasonal, maybe even perennial part to all of this. I know you have a story about moving from one organization to another for money, and it didn't last very long. Is that right?
Yeah. So as a young analyst, it was in the days where, a bit like soccer stars, where it's not really like this anymore, but the top analyst could fetch a big price, and a big premium was placed on his head. And I was, at the age of 29, I was at Deutsche Bank, and had just been rated the top analyst in the country. And Merrill Lynch wanted me on board.
Is this the first time you were rated as that, by the way?
I think it was the second or third time. It was after 4 years in the industry.
Okay.
So Merrill Lynch and the CEO of Merrill Lynch came to my house every night, 7 days in a row, with a bigger and bigger check.
Okay, wow.
And eventually I succumbed, and I resigned from Deutsche Bank to a guy called Murray Winkler, who could not have treated me better and was a fantastic mentor and brilliant brilliant human being. And I literally just moved for money. Okay. And 2 months after doing it, there's no amount of money that's worth kind of giving up your soul, I guess. So that was a lesson from then onwards.
Literally 2 months.
2 months into it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. And Merrill Lynch at the time was it's a cold, hard American institution. Mm. So you went from a place that had developed you and helps develop your culture and instinct to a place where it was at that stage, it was run by fax from New York. Mm. And you couldn't make any decisions. And subsequently, I left after 1 year there. I'd had a contract. And it's not in my nature to, the places that I've worked,
seven,
eight, 10 years, whatever. And it just didn't fit for me. Mm. So if you go through your career, people must also understand there's times when you have luck, and there's times when you have good luck and bad luck. Mm. There's times when I felt very rich. There's times when I've been bankrupt. And if the correlation between money and happiness is the graphs don't necessarily correlate. Mm. So money enables you to be happier, but it doesn't guarantee happiness. So you've got to focus on, the things that turn you on in work and the people around you. I mean, business and work is all about the people that you collect around you and how you work as a team.
I'm interested in understanding your approach to team and the growth of Anchor Capital. We haven't really touched on that just yet. It's part of your journey, and it's also part of your entrepreneurial feeling that you had that drove you in a particular direction. We'll get there in a moment. I'm just interested in one or two other moments that you may have had, because I reflect and I understand our future CEOs community, and often we get to interact at events and people ask certain kinds of questions. And also what also happens is that we may now talk after this conversation that's on air and other stories come out. I don't want that to happen here.
Yeah.
While we're on this idea of one or two lows, so that period may not have been the right fit for you. There must have been one or two other lows in your career, or a lull or two. Can you share an experience or two that you have experienced And then perhaps some of the lessons that came out of that.
Yeah, so two very distinct episodes along the way. I left the stock market at the age of about 30 and ran a business called Africam.
Okay.
Which was it broadcast wildlife all over the world. It was in the top 20 websites in the world. And we had a listing document with Merrill Lynch to list it for $250 million in London.
Yeah, exciting.
So I felt like I was the king of the world. I was on the front page of the Financial Mail. You know, kind of that internet celebrity type status as to the extent that that existed back in 2000. And then the
2000,
whole
important dates.
Yeah. So the whole internet world collapsed and literally our funder pulled out. The business wasn't profitable. None of them were at that stage. And literally from over a 6 month period, I went from hero to failed business, lying on the couch, wondering what the hell to do with my life. I guess, you know, the business lessons from that are, understanding your business model. Like, does the business model work? It's pointless trying to do something which doesn't have a revenue stream or the right profit. So putting all your efforts into something which there's got to be an end game that you understand. And that was, we were pioneers. I mean, nobody in the world knew how to make money out of the internet.
Yeah, exactly.
But a wonderful journey.
Yeah.
No, and absolutely no regrets. So we came back from that. I went back into the analyst world and I knew that I could do that as good as anybody and, you know, carried on in the financial services game for the next, I think 13, 14 years until I started my own business. And then the other one was 2008 and the stock market crash. You know, I remember I'd broken my leg. I'd had surgery on my leg.
Okay.
Gone into work. I'd fainted because I had to have my leg up, went back home.
Oh, really? Okay.
And the market was crashing. And I remember I always said to my wife, you know, there's Wall Street movies where you see share prices going down by the second. That's not reality. I remember sitting with a laptop with my leg up in the sky, with the phone ringing off the hook. I had a R1 billion fund. We'd lost R100 million in one day. I was watching the TV screen. Bear Stearns literally went down 30% while I was watching it on Bloomberg.
Yeah,
getting phone calls from clients going, "What the hell are you doing? You've destroyed me." I kind of had a moment of reflection and I went, "This is as bad as it can get. It can get no worse." And that's quite a positive moment because you go, that was the lowest moment of my life.
Sure.
And maybe not, you know, there's personal things that can happen to you from, I don't want to dismiss personal tragedies and the like. But from a business point of view, realizing that if you can have the resilience to see that through, and be able to sit back, think rationally, find solutions, you know, get out of it, and also to realize that, you know, to diversify and to understand you can have bad luck and the unthinkable can happen. So to make sure you've got all scenarios covered. You know, in our business, we certainly approach it like that, where what's the best case, what's the worst case, and what's the outcome in each of those situations? Because I think a lot of entrepreneurs, I mean, I love taking a risk and developing something. I left Investec without a plan. I was just going to go and start my own business. I didn't have a structure I just knew I was going to do it. So you have that kind of unfettered confidence and ambition and belief in yourself, but you also have to measure that with what happens if it doesn't work? What's my fallback?
Yeah,
what's the plan?
I'm concerned. There's a tempering that needs to happen there.
Yeah. I guess when I started my business, I sold a 25% stake to a guy called Ivan Clark from Grinrod. He didn't give me much money, but he gave me the security of access to more money if it took longer than expected.
Okay.
So, you know, it's putting in place that fallback situation where if it takes longer, if we do battle a bit, what are you going to do? Because you don't, you know, once in my life I've been in a situation where a business couldn't continue running. You know, I had to stand in front of 50 people and retrench them all in one day.
Yeah, that's no good.
You know, I was the one of the people who's doing it came and gave me a hug because I was the one with tears rolling down my cheek. You know, you just want to avoid getting in a situation where that can happen.
I'm interested in this entrepreneurial spirit it's a golden thread that has followed you or is throughout your life, it seems. And you spoke about from a very young age being the guy that was wheeling and dealing with in suites back then. It's a little bit of a different story today. But you're sitting in Investec. You're in a position which is a fairly powerful, coveted position. Our future CEOs are going to look at that and they're going to say, "Wow, that's remarkable." But then what you've just said is you left almost without a plan. what I don't want to do is go to the leaving without a plan just yet. But that feeling inside of you, how are you dealing with this? You've got this entrepreneurial drive, but you also, there's this other part to you as well that's alive and kicking, and you're being successful. How did you balance those energies?
Yes, I think it's just, I think a lot of it is inherent. You know, you either, okay. It's appetite.
Okay.
So it's how you respond when that adrenaline hits you.
Mm.
And it either excites you or scares the living daylights out of you. And if it doesn't scare you a little, then you probably shouldn't be taking it. And because it's that fear that motivates you very strongly.
Mm.
But the belief in yourself that, that you can make it work, and if you'll find a way to package your skills. And the other beautiful thing about business, and really what is business? It's just a collection of people with a plan and a brand around it.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, you know, what I find absolutely fascinating is there's this building, you put a whole lot of people in it, you call yourself something, you develop a strategy, and a year later, it's a business, and it has a value and identity.
Mm.
And people talk to me about our business as like kind of a living organism. So there's an absolute fascination in creating that, you know, that you can create this effectively living organism in the business world. And that's, you know, that either appeals to you or it doesn't.
Mm.
So certain people should be employees, and certain people simply don't have the appetite to go and take that have that risk appetite to take the risk.
Yeah, it's okay to be these things. I think the what certainly we mustn't get caught up in is the let's call it the propaganda machine that says entrepreneurs and startups and all of these things are the way to go. I mean, I love the way your litmus test, which was if it scares you, maybe you should be doing it. If it scares you too much, perhaps back off a little.
Yeah. Other thing that I've learned, I mean, I was always going to work for myself and create my own thing. That was my mindset from the time I was 10 years old.
Okay.
But what you also realize, I've got mates and colleagues and peers who've built up brilliant careers as employees in big businesses and have in fact created more value than many entrepreneurs. So there's also you don't have to be an entrepreneur. You can be an entrepreneur in a business, and some people just find that more comfortable because they've got their fallback position. But your being an entrepreneur doesn't mean you have to own your own business.
Mm.
You can be an entrepreneur in a business.
Mm.
And in fact, you know, if there's resources in a business, people have created enormous wealth within business.
I've always wondered about that because they talk about entrepreneurship, the I. So this is this idea of being an entrepreneur in a business. But there's certain kinds of restrictions in that kind of environment that but then also there are, as you say, safe places as well if you can get it right. Let's move into your journey as an entrepreneur. So you leave Investec. You say you don't have a plan, but you have put safety in place for yourself. What do you do next? What's the first conversation you have after Investec is now a thing of the past?
Yeah, so quite fortuitously, I found a guy who had a business registered. I bought 95% of it from him for 200,000 rands. It was a small venture. So you needed a structure. Then you needed, you know, I understood what I was good at. And the asset management industry is a fantastic, very profitable industry if you can get it right.
Mm.
So I tried in the internet world to recreate the future.
Mm.
Had a great time going and seeing polar bears in Canada and golden lion tamarin monkeys in Brazil. And it was a hell of an adventure.
Yeah.
But then I realized, in fact, and this is probably an important lesson as well, is to be an entrepreneur in something that you understand and have got some experience in.
The freedom of a tight brief, as they say, in the creative world, I think.
Mm. Yeah. So I then, you know, so I had the company set up. I needed, I'd hired two or sort of partnered with two or three other guys because to get the job done, there's certain skills that you need and competence. So there were about four of us that set off on the journey. And then I needed a client. So then it was basically hitting the phone and hitting the street and going out there and basically convincing people that they should back you.
And tell, I mean, that experience, how long did it take you to get your first client? Are you that convincing that it was a matter of days, or I'm just wondering?
Yeah, so it probably took 2 or 3 months.
Okay.
Our first client doesn't know he was our first client. You're selling yourself on your past skills, but you've created this organism.
Sure.
So we're selling you anchor capital, and these are the skills, and this is my personal background.
Yeah.
You're just hoping he doesn't ask, tell me, have you got any other clients?
Yeah, give me a testimonial.
And then we had a lot of good fortune in our first year, where Optimum Coal, there was a group of guys who bought it from Billiton. It subsequently became embroiled in that, that associated with the Guptas, but that was a few owners later.
Yeah.
But there were four guys who sold their stake in it. They made a great success out of it. And, I won their trust and got all of the money that they got out of it. So by the end of the first year, we'd got to R1 billion. In asset management, the difficulty is getting things rolling.
That momentum.
Because people will back you if you've got money that's invested. So, but at the end of the first year, I think we had R1 billion of assets, and about 800 million came from those four guys.
Okay.
But it gave you the credibility. You know, people know that you've got R1 billion that you're investing. They go, okay, other people trust him. You develop your track record.
That was like a social proof of sorts, I guess.
Sure, sure. Mm.
Okay. And so you emerge from a history in some fairly technical, but then also leadership positions. You then are the CEO, founder and CEO, but really a CEO of an organization that is growing and developing and emerging quite quickly. And suddenly there's a shift, and it becomes less technical and more people. When did you feel that shift, and how did you feel about that shift?
The moment your business becomes bigger than one room.
Okay.
So I think there were about 10 of us sitting in one room, and it's just a team working together, and people have got access and time with you all the time. So you know, if you've got some empathy and I guess some natural leadership and the ability to communicate, if people have got contact with you, it's easy. Once you move into two rooms, it changes. And once you move, you know, we're now in London, Mauritius, four offices. Yeah,
lots of rooms.
And the ability then to, you know, you then have to have structure and work out how to do it differently. And everybody's got that kind of learning journey. Mm. And you've got to find a way of connecting with people when you're physically in a different place. And developing the process and discipline of keeping up the communication. I've got to make 250 people feel like, you know, we've gone from four people to 250 people. We did that in 5 years. And you've got to make them all feel that you're there for them.
Yeah.
Because you physically can't be. There aren't enough minutes in a day. So that's a difficult one to master, and you've got to work out your own techniques.
Who was it? Mark Cutifani, Anglo-American CEO. He was sharing, and we were just discussing his day and what his day would look like. And he would describe a situation where he was on the phone at 3 a.m., and I mean, there's really an interesting work-life balance. I've come to understand that people are saying there's no such thing as work-life balance. It's now work-life integration, work-life integration. And how have you been able to deal with that? So you've got offices all around the world, which means that you can be called across different time zones, probably late at night. How ready are you for that? Or how ready were you for that?
Not at all. Okay. I mean, it's a difficult one, and the managing that is probably my biggest challenge in life. Mm. So it's
What do you mean? You mean managing yourself in that because it's you want to work all the time, or is it just managing the necessity of it?
Well, it's just the range of different things you've got to do across your business and personal life. I guess the thing that challenges me the most is that the day is not long enough to do all the things I want to do. Mm. So prioritize is the answer. Get probably one of the most useful things I ever got. You know, you get these business tips on the internet.
Yes,
and
the one that
I've implemented the most is I get to work at 6:30 every morning. And what are the five things that are going to make a difference? What are the five important things?
Mm.
And get those done early in the day when you've got the energy, as opposed to a lot of people, you know, sit down and clear their email inbox for 2 hours, and you've used all your sharpest energy for you know, for menial tasks.
Yeah.
And then just have a non-negotiable family time. So it's, you know, make sure that time is dedicated, but it's, I don't really feel that many minutes of the day are on my own.
Mm.
When you run a business, and especially a listed business, I've got 4,800 shareholders now in the stock market, and each of them theoretically has got access to you.
Yeah.
So you become a bit of a prisoner of the public to an extent, but that you choose that, and you've got to relish that and be able to, but you can't, I guess one of the difficult things, you can never step away from it.
Mm.
So you can't decide that I'm not the CEO for the next month. You're the CEO until you're not the CEO.
Yeah.
It's not a job that you can do part time, and it's you the CEO 24 hours a day. You don't stop being the CEO at 8 o'clock at night.
What I so appreciate about what you've just shared is that you've chosen it. You've made a decision. You got to own that space. I think that often there seem to be not often. I've encountered more and more regularly nowadays that people just seem to make these flippant decisions that and just as easily will change their minds and go back on their word. From the sounds of you, it seems, and you mentioned it earlier when you were saying it's not in my character to have walked away from it was Merrill Lynch, I think.
Walked away from Deutsche Bank.
The way that you had, after such a short period of time there. Just a word on character and the way that you look at it, and then I've got a mechanism that I heard from Shamil. I beg your pardon, from Greg Solomon, CEO of McDonald's, that I'll share with you. But just a word on character and the way that you look at character, especially when you reflect on your employees.
Yeah, so I think
and team
integrity and character is everything. I think if you're willing to give up on that at any point in time, you know, it's going to come back to haunt you. So
how do you know though? I'm thinking of a scenario where you're trying to pull someone into your team. How do you know?
How do you know what?
How do you know that they've got integrity? How do you know that you can trust them? How do you know that what they're showing you is authentic and real?
Yeah, so I mean, in terms of process, anybody that you hire, I want to speak to three people about them, three people that I respect. And we're in a small industry.
That you respect, that's an interesting condition.
So, I mean, that's the process, and that's the best way of doing it. But also, I'm a massive believer in gut feel. You know, it's basically all your years of experience synthesized into one signal to the front of your brain to say yes or no. And it's the times in that you can get it wrong. You know, there's times if you look back in your life, the times when your gut feel said no and you still went ahead with it, and 90% of the times you were right, but you didn't act on what your gut feel said. So, you know, I think if I interview somebody within a minute, you've probably made 80% of your decision. Mm. And there's obviously a lot more to you. There's lots of detail and checking up and that kind of thing. But I think, especially, you know, the longer you've been in business, the more that kind of works.
Yeah, sure. I mean, there's going to be this experience bell that will ring time and time again. Greg Solomon shared that when he looks at someone and he wants to pull them into his team, what he'll do, and it's very subjective, because he knows the numbers are probably, the fundamentals are right, but he'll look at the individual and he'll give them a rating on two scales, one which is trust and one which is respect. So out of 10, how much do I trust this person? Out of 10, how much do I respect you, Peter? And then he takes those two numbers and multiplies them together, gets a very simple formula. But if it doesn't get over 80, then he just says no.
Yeah.
It's either not the right time or you're not the right person.
One other personal sticking point that I've got in you know, interviewing somebody and bringing somebody across, I'll ask them about, in fact, I learned this from a partner of mine, Matthew Norjung. He asked them about the other people that they work with at the moment.
Okay.
And if people speak, if you can see their default is to bring out, you know, talk badly
speak
about other
ill
people,
about them.
That's typically a pretty bad sign.
Yeah, someone also shared, who was it? Clive Butko. He shared that what he'll do is he wants to interact with that person in three different environments. And one of the environments he'll take them is to a restaurant somewhere, so that he can look at how they interact with people that they may regard as lesser than them.
Yeah.
Is
that's
this
respect.
Person,
respect
yeah,
is huge.
Exactly. Yeah. Is this person kind to the waiting staff?
Yeah.
There's a nice point there.
And there's a lot to be said for kindness.
Yeah, there is.
I think to be a leader, you need to have inherent kindness.
Mm. No, I agree with you. On that note, one of the questions we ask everyone that sits in the seat that you're sitting now is around their leadership style and their approach to leadership. What are your three pillars of CEO leadership? What is this emerging learning that you are experiencing?
So, I mean, you can define that in a number of different ways. I think having a plan, so a strategy.
Okay.
That's a huge pillar. It's very easy to fill up your day with just getting your work done.
Busy.
You've got to know where you're heading. Where do you want to be in 1 year's time and 3 years' time, and what's the plan and what people do you need to get there?
Mm.
I think empathy, and this sort of relates to the third one, which is people and the ability to identify, attract, motivate, and get the best out of people. You know, if you can get 20% more out of each of the people around you,
that's big.
That's massive.
Mm.
And that, you know, the 20 is incremental. And so in order to do that, you need to have empathy. You've got to actually care about the people. And I think where a lot of CEOs fail is they tell a good story, but they, at the bottom of their heart, they don't really care.
Mm.
So, yeah, I mean, it's I guess a combination of those three things are, not everything about leadership, but the things that I think are important.
Mm. You've spoken about this idea of not caring, and I guess when is too much caring? So, because empathy is important, but sympathy can be quite destructive.
Yeah, and I'm too soft.
Okay.
But I can't really fundamentally change.
Mm.
I can act tougher, but I think the biggest realization is understanding that about yourself. And one of the big parts of leadership is understanding what you are and what you aren't.
Mm.
So if you get in a situation which requires some toughness, I get help. I've got to understand when I'm not going to be tough enough. And don't, you know, if you're cognizant of it, you can still make the right decision and make the tough decision. But you've got to motivate yourself to do it.
Mm.
You know, so some people will go too far the other way. They'll be too tough, and that creates damage.
Mm.
If you're not tough enough, that creates damage because people want to see somebody who can make decisions and make tough decisions.
People I think people naturally follow. And I don't know how well we understand this, is that people actually want to follow. It's quite an interesting, unique thing. It's a human experience, really.
Sure, absolutely. So the people want to be led, and they want to see somebody that they respect and will make the right decisions. And often you listen, and make the decision. People want somebody to take a lot of people don't want to make the decision.
Mm.
So there's a group of eight people in a room. There's a point at which you've got to go, I've heard all of you. That's great. And I respect, we don't all agree. This is the decision.
Yeah.
People want that point.
Mm.
And often in a business, I've had to train myself to do that because I'm perhaps inherently a little scared to offend, and because your decision might offend three of the eight people in the room.
Sure.
But the right thing is to make the call and to have the discipline and, you know, to follow through with it. And people want a plan.
Mm.
They want to know how they're fitting into that plan, what their role is, how they're going to get incentivized on it. And that's all about the strategy and structure.
Mm. You were speaking about getting help. We like to talk about mentorship here, and often we look to you as a guide or a mentor to our future CEOs and to us as well. But you must have your own mentors. You must have those that you look to, whether they are present or not, whether it's through a book or a documentary or something. Who are the people that you look up to that you respect enough to listen to?
Yeah, so I think you know, it's kind of my business partners and the people that have grown the business with me.
Mm. That's such a valuable thing. That I think another gentleman that was here, Irfan Padesi. We were having a conversation, and it was a lunch at in Sandton somewhere, and he had asked me a question about a small little business that I wanted to start, and he said, "Do you have a business partner?" And I said, no. And he says, you're going to fail. And I thought that was quite a – I'm like, hold on. Irfan, do you know who I am?
Yeah, sure.
But he said, you're going to fail. And part of that could have been skills, but part of that is what you're describing here, which is a relationship that you develop that is really supportive and you need potentially in the hard times.
Yeah. There isn't one person that has taught me everything I know. Mm. I think a good skill to learn is to feed the best of different people around you.
Mm.
And I've learned and effectively been mentored by people junior to me and senior to me. Mm. If they've got an attitude or methodology or way of doing things, there's people who, there's a number of business people around me who I'll phone for different pieces of advice. And it's, one guy might tell you how to sell, and the next guy might be helping you with the strategy of your business. The next guy might just be a voice of reason or somebody to speak to. And there's people you want to bounce crazy ideas off.
Mm.
And it's, I naturally go to different people depending on what I'm wanting some inspiration or help or assistance with.
Mm.
But it's, I think that's the big challenge as an entrepreneur. I started the business, I owned the business, I controlled it, I made every decision. As you get bigger and bigger, you just can't work like that. And
sure.
That's quite a journey. Is to get to a point where you actually go, that's that person's domain and they can make the decisions and off you go. And actually sometimes you want to get involved and you want to get your hands in it and make the decision, but you've got to step away and let them do it.
It's an interesting question, and it's an interesting point of reflection, which is the question around what kind of entrepreneur are you? I'm not going to ask you that question now, but the question must be asked: Are you a starter? Are you someone that takes a business that is really there to scale? Are you a scale, really good at scaling something? Are you the person that's going to get the best price at exit? There's different phases. Mm. There are different types of individuals. You spoke about mentors, people that guide you. You also spoke about feeding off different people, what's the worst advice you've ever received? That's an interesting question.
The worst advice. I'm not sure. It's a beautiful question. I don't know.
Okay.
The light bulb will hit me as we're talking.
As we're walking out the studio, it'll come to you, and that's okay. Let's see if we can get that.
I'll come back to that. Yeah.
In your journey, and I think let's begin winding down the conversation. Just a few quick questions. What book would you recommend, please? A book that has made the most impact on you and your ability to grow your business or settle in your career or just something.
The Google book. I think it was just called Google. I'm not sure what the journey of that and, the art of what's possible. The beautiful thing about business is I've got no idea where we'll be a year's time from now.
Mm.
And there'll be challenges, there'll be opportunities, and you've got to approach it with that mindset. You've got to have a strategy and a plan, but you've got to understand that the waters will go in different directions and different things will come up. But it's, if you've got the right people around you and the right set of skills, you can create something special. So, that Google and what they created, what they set off to do and what it became, effectively one of the world's top five businesses, from nothing in a short time period. I loved it because I was starting an internet business at the same time.
Yeah.
And they made no money for years and years and years. They had the capital to carry on with it.
You're an analyst. There's a research element to your nature. Just a almost one of the last questions that we'll ask here is, when you look out, and right now it is September 2018, when you look at the world, what is the thing that you're most excited by? And then what is the next question is, what are you I don't want to say concerned, but what are you uncertain about? What's that thing that's less exciting but more disconcerting than exciting?
I've got the answer to the worst.
Oh, you do?
The worst advice, which we can come back to.
Okay.
So the thing that excites me most is, it sounds absurd and trite.
Okay.
But waking up in the morning and having there's so much you can do in an 8 or 10 hour time period. And I like to, at the end of the day, look back and go, how did I change my little world or somebody else's world in a day? And that's very airy fairy, but it's there's so much opportunity, and what I absolutely love, we were talking about it earlier, is just this creation of this organism and the ability, if I add five more good people to my business, I can increase the value of my business by 30 or 40%. And it's the ability to combine all those skills and get people to working together and getting this organism.
See, I don't think it's trite. I think it's counter complaining culture. I think there's an optimism there. And there's an ownership there that is remarkable, and it's why you sit here with us today. It's not trite in any form or fashion. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. So that's the thing that you're most optimistic about. What is it that's something that caused a little bit of apprehension for you?
So I think it's more about, I think the world's going to be quite a sad place in 50 years' time.
Okay.
So it's almost more of a personal thing. I'm worried about the world that my kids will live in 50 years' time. That could start impacting business and opportunities in probably 5 or 10 years. But
what's the source of that?
The extinction of animals, the natural cycle of the world. I think the potential with technology, there's some quite horrific and terrifying potential with technology.
We're talking about AI, robotics.
Elon Musk said that the other day, once we've invented a robot that's cleverer than us, we're over.
Yeah. It's alarming.
And I think probably the thing that makes me saddest about the world is, I mean, if you look at how many countries in the world effectively have a dictator and I'm the most optimistic person in the world, and one of the things that I hate is as you get older and older, you realize there's a lot of people out there who are actually evil. You know, I used to have a fight with my old boss at Investec. I would say trust somebody until they let you down, and he would say distrust everybody until they prove otherwise.
Okay.
Which is two philosophical points, and I'm certainly in the camp of trust people, but I've definitely become a lot more skeptical about human beings as you grow older. And, you know, if you just look at the ability of human greed is such a big factor. And, you know, in South Africa, we've seen that almost destroy, the beautiful place that we want to work for our children.
Okay, thank you. I don't think we've hit a downer by sharing that. I think what this is, it's a bit of a dose of reality that we must just keep our eyes open. We can't look below the horizon. We must look up at the horizon or above. Thank you for sharing. You remembered your worst advice, by the way.
So my father went on a Dale Carnegie course.
Okay.
And he came out, and his advice to me was win a point, lose a friend.
Okay.
Which is the most absurd advice I've ever received in my life.
All right.
By implication, step back from arguments.
Yeah, let them.
You know, avoid confrontation. Rather find it's fun. Reach an outcome which is acceptable to everybody. But it's, I think that had quite a, that sort of advice and theme had quite a negative influence on how I engaged with people.
Okay.
And it took me quite a few years when I got into the business world. Like when I said I'm not tough enough, it comes from that sort of thinking.
I think I relate to you. I must admit on this particular point, this, you want to naturally be a soft and gentle and kind and generous, but.
But often you're not in a business. If you don't deal with things the right way, you're actually being unkind.
Yeah.
If there's a staff member who's destabilizing the rest of the staff.
Exactly.
You have to be unkind to that person. They have to go. And if they don't, you're actually harming the other 249 people by not getting rid of that one person.
I agree with you. I think we've just about run out of time here, but it's been a fascinating conversation, and we're so very grateful for you sharing so much of your journey with us and insight into what has brought you to the point that you are today. Maybe a final question, if I may, and we ask everyone that walks through that door and sits in this seat, we ask this question, and it is, if you could go back in time and speak to the young future CEO you, the 21-year-old future CEO you, what would you say to yourself? What's that one or two or maybe three things that you would say to yourself?
I'd say, and I've kind of always been happy to do it, I would say from a business point of view, go and take the risk and get started, but have a plan. The other phrase I quite like is equity is forever.
Okay.
So yes. Often you start a business and you flippantly give somebody 5 or 10 or 15% at the beginning. That they're your partner and they're your shield and they benefit from whatever you do for a hell of a long time. Mm. And probably the biggest thing I've learned in business is to understand who you are and supplement. You need a suite of skills, understand what you are and what you aren't, mm. and supplement yourself with those skills around you.
Mm. Peter, thank you very much for joining us here at Cliff Central and the Future CEO Show. We so appreciate it. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Great to be here.
That's the voice of Peter Armitage, the CEO of Anchor Capital. And that's all we have time for you this week. We will see you same time, same place next week, doing the same thing, sitting across from these incredible leaders, learning from them in behalf of you so that you can expedite the growth of your career and your business. We'll see you same time, same place then.
Future CEOs on CliffCentral.com.
Win an entrepreneurial package worth 2 million rand with Alpha Code. Alpha Code is inviting applications for its prestigious Alpha Code Incubate program that seeks to identify and reward high-potential, innovative entrepreneurs to boost the development of fintech and financial services in South Africa. 16 businesses will be invited to pitch for 8 places on the Alpha Code Incubate program. The final 8 businesses will complete a customized 12-month program and will benefit from an entrepreneurial package worth 2 million rand each. The package consists of 1 million rand in grant funding, 1 million rand worth of support including mentorship, monthly expert-led sessions, exclusive office space in Sandton, marketing, legal, and other business support services, as well as access to RMI's networks. The first round of applications closed this Friday, 7th September 2018. Terms and conditions apply. Find out more on the CliffCentral.com website.
This is CliffCentral.com.